one of America's most respected White House correspondents, is British. Meet Victoria Jones soon.
This is London Calling.
I'm Graham Mack and welcome to this week's show. Let's start by talking about Britain's most secretive organisation, the Royal Family. Right now, there's a crowdsourcing campaign going on so that a legal challenge can be mounted that would allow access to the Royal Archive. Now, these are kept in the Round Tower at Windsor Castle, personal and official documents of kings and queens from the past 250 years. In this country, we have freedom of information requests. You have the right to request information from any publicly funded body and get answers. That is a lie. That's the wording on the website, whatdotheyknow.com. It actually says, you have the right, and right is in bold, you have the right to request information from any publicly funded body. Well, you don't, because you don't have the right to request information from the Royal Archive. So there's an anti-monarchy group called Republic. So this crowdfunding thing by these Republicans, they want to pay money to see if they can find some kind of loophole so we can get access to this information. They're saying that all of the records should be transferred to the National Archive at Kew. There's an author, Ben McIntyre, he's written books about spies and the SAS. He says the royal family has taken secrecy to a new level.
One of the ironies is that, in fact, MI5, our security service, is considerably more accessible historically than the royal family. Every year, MI5 releases archives that do not have a security implication.
Ben McIntyre. Wow. He says the royal family are more secretive than MI5, and MI5 are trusted with keeping secrets. In America, there is a little bit of fuss about the American head of state not releasing his tax returns. In this country, our head of state won't release any information about her or any of our previous heads of state for the past 250 years. And never mind tax returns, our head of state doesn't even have to pay tax. She does it voluntarily now, but didn't until 1992. So she could volunteer to not bother. If things get a bit tight, she could give it a miss one year if she wants. But we'd never know, because it's all secret. A school in the English county of Kent made the news this week because they're giving kids detention for getting the hiccups. Helen, you're in Stevenage, Hertfordshire.
Hiya. Just wanted to say, your story about kids hiccuping in cars.
Yes.
My son Thomas got a detention at Barnwell School for the same thing.
Now, when somebody hiccups in class, it's one of the funniest things ever. Why can't the teachers roll with it? Shouldn't learning be fun?
It should, but he couldn't stop, and then all of his mates started giggling, and it all spiralled out of control, and he got a behaviour detention at Barnwell.
Well, I'm sorry, that seems a bit harsh to me. I think the teacher should have had a good laugh and said, listen, mate, go and get yourself a glass of water, drink it upside down, and come back when you sort it out. And that should be the end of it. It shouldn't be, he shouldn't get detention for hiccups.
He probably takes it too far and they play on it as well, though.
Yes, I know they do. That's why the teacher should just say, look, it's really funny. Come on, sort yourself. Go and get yourself a glass of water. Go and sort yourself out. Come back when you've got it cured. And then the other kids can then get on with the learning. And then that kid knows he has to, just like if you were in a meeting at work in the real world, and you got the hiccups, you'd have to excuse yourself, go out to the toilets, get yourself a glass of water, drink it upside down, do whatever it does, and then you'd come back into the meeting when the hiccups have gone. That's what you wouldn't, but they wouldn't, at work, they wouldn't hold that against you forever on your record that you got the hiccups. Do you know what? That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, but the behaviour detentions are quite common at schools now.
Well, that's because the teachers are becoming power-hungry megalomaniacs instead of educators. Thank you very much, Helen. Bye. Hello, Mick.
You talk about the boy who got a contention for hiccups.
Yes.
It worked the other way around when I was at school.
What happened?
I was a little bit late for one of the lessons. Yeah. This teacher, woodwork teacher, he had a really foul temper and he kept screaming and shouting at the kids. Well, he sent me out into the corridor.
Yeah.
And he started screaming and shouting at me. I just stood there trying to take it all in. And one of the teachers behind, who does in another block behind, is a glass door, started putting faces behind his back.
Right.
And he was sticking his tongue out and putting his fingers in his ears and waving his fingers around. And I was trying not to laugh at his teacher. And this teacher was screaming and shouting at me, and I was trying not to laugh. And then in the end, I just burst out laughing, and he went mental, the teacher did. And I went, it's Mr. Whiffin over there. And he turned around behind him, and he ducked behind his door so he couldn't see him. And he thought I was taking the mick out of him. And it was actually the teacher who was doing the laughing, not the kids.
Making it worse. Well, it sounds like he had a good sense of humour. Did you deserve a shouting at from the woodwork teacher?
He was a nightmare. He used to throw bits of wood and shout, duck. And if it hit you, he used to go, I told you to duck.
Yeah. Yeah, we had a... Miss Needham used to be lethal with a board duster as well. Board rubber. She used to... Yeah, see, what happened to that kind of teacher? I mean, obviously throwing things at kids is wrong, but what happened to the... what happened to the teacher that realised we're here to learn stuff and if we can have fun along the way, more's the better. I mean, detention for the hiccups, that's just stupid, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, I'll tell you, one of my friends used to always walk out of lessons, and this teacher got the up with him. He kept on saying, well, he keeps on walking out the lessons. So what he did is he sat him on the bench and he got a chisel and he chiseled his trouser leg to the bench so he couldn't walk out. And we all went into the next class, and when we went back again, all there was a pair of trousers on this bench where the geezer just got his trousers off and walked out in his underpants.
Jim in Philadelphia is back on via Skype, and Jim, you'll be glad to know I've been going to a lot more football games lately, soccer. My team, Liverpool, been an up-and-down season. We got beaten by Leicester, but then we beat high-flying Arsenal.
Yeah.
It's funny that the bloke who I go to the match with, he has a season ticket to Liverpool, and his son has a season ticket as well. And his son is saving up for a house, so he doesn't want to go, but he doesn't want to give up his season ticket because the waiting list is, you know, I've been on it for 10 years and I'm nowhere near the top. So his son doesn't go, but his father kind of sells the seat. You know, I give him the exact money, not over the odds, the exact money for that game. Like I gave him 37 right. quid on Saturday, and he just loans me his son's season ticket and I sit next to him. And so this is like the fourth game that I've done it this way with this fella this season.
And that's, you know, a pretty good arrangement then.
It's a very good arrangement because he's, you know, his son is getting the cash to help, you know, save up for his house, and I get to go to the match, and, you know, and I'm always with someone who I know and can meet there, and, you know, I don't know him that well. I only ever see him at the football, but, you know, you get to chat and talk about the game and what's going on. And his name's Steve, and I said to him, oh, how's your week been then, Steve? He says, not good. He said, I was diagnosed with cancer.
Oh.
And I'm like, God, you know, oh, wow. And it's his throat or something. He's got to go in for a procedure on this coming Wednesday. So I'll send him a text and, you know, wish him well. I said, oh, how was that then? And he said, when the doctor, he says, it's just one of those things. And he's just like, oh, well, if it gets me, it gets me. If this thing works, then it doesn't get me. He's just really philosophical about it. He said, when the doctor told him he had cancer, that, you know, he said, all right, yeah. The doctor said, well, that's an odd reaction. You know, normally I get a different reaction to that. And apparently Steve said to the doctor, oh, I've had worse things this week. I was at the Liverpool-Leicester game. Because we got beaten by Leicester. He said that to the doctor. And like at half time, no joke, in the football match, Liverpool-Arsenal, at half time, he's filling in the form, basically his will. He's writing his will.
My all.
At half time during the match. And then before the second half kicked off, he rang his solicitor to query a few points on this form that he's filling in. It's basically a will that you fill in the boxes, you know?
Yeah. Oh, and then I'm surprised he didn't ask you afterwards. Would you be a witness to this? Here you are.
Yeah, I was expecting that. But I had a bad thought at that very moment. I thought, if the worst does happen, who are you leaving your season ticket to?
I just thought that just crossed my mind then.
You know, because your son's got one.
Where are your season tickets going?
Shouldn't have had that thought, but didn't say anything.
I had a thought. My father's wife uses the expression, "Oh, that's too funny. Oh, that's too funny."
Right.
Well, most everything. Oh, you've drank too much. There's a consequence.
Yes.
That's too expensive. You're not going to buy it.
Yeah. Too dangerous. Yeah.
It's too. I'm not going to do that. It's too dangerous. It's a downside.
Yeah.
That's too funny. What happens?
Maybe you wet yourself. I don't know.
Is there a panel that's? I'm sorry. I'm going to have to stop you there.
Yeah.
This stand-up routine is quite good. In fact, it's too funny.
Oh, trust me, Jim.
You have to stop it.
I have worked for radio station program directors who think there is such a thing as too funny. Seriously? No, really.
I'm sorry. We're going to have to stop you. That's, no.
No, they did stop me. A Fiverr C Mount Gambier, a bloke called he told me, "Right, you're being too funny. From now on, I want only one joke or phone call per half hour."
Really?
Yeah. And I said to him, "You know, no one's going to die if I tell two jokes in a half hour. No one's going to die.
There is no such thing as too funny.
No. Especially when it was breakfast radio. People are listening in 10-minute blocks. So one joke or phone call per half hour.
Too funny.
There was another program director I worked for. No, it was the first one. Paul at 2PK Parks. And I can't remember what the bit was I did. And I was on in the afternoon. And he said, "You did that one at, I think I'd done it at like somewhere between 5:30 and 6 o'clock at night. I was on till 7. My shift was 3 in the afternoon till 7. And I'd done something at some stage." And he goes,
"It's a tough shift."
Yeah, yeah. Oh, it's Australian. They work you out. And he said, when you did that one, what do you think people were doing?" And I went, "Well, hopefully they were laughing." And he went, no. What were they doing in their life at about that time of the evening?" And I went, "Oh, I don't know." He goes, "They could have been having their meal." And I went, "All right. Yeah, that's not really the thing people want to hear when they're eating." And I went, "Did we get a complaint from someone who was made ill by that joke?" No.
They could have been. Is not cause for complaint.
I had that all the time. At 2PK, I once said to him, he said, "You told a joke a week last Tuesday or something." And I, "What?" I couldn't even remember it. And he said, "Yeah, you shouldn't have done that one." And I went, "Okay, why not? Give me a steer here so I know which way to pitch the material." And he went, "No, I was in such and such shop or something, and a woman came up to me and she realized I worked for 2PK, and she told me she found that offensive." And I went, "So does that count as a complaint? Because it's like a week and a half after the event, she didn't call in to complain. She found out you worked at the radio station and she thought she'd mentioned something." I said, and he was really winding me up. And I said, "Which shop is it? I want to go down there because I'm sitting in this office with you. I should be really talking to her about the show because she's the one that's calling the shots here, not you. She's the one that is programming this radio station, not you. She's certainly got more say in my show than I do." Oh, fun. I've worked for some funny people. Wow. Yeah, but you can be too funny in radio, apparently.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. You would have thought. Oh, too funny.
I've worked for some idiots. I worked for one bloke, and I was doing a nighttime show. I was on 7 till midnight at 2GO on the Central Coast, 7 till midnight, 5 hours a night. It's a nighttime show. It's really of no consequence. Just play the hits and keep them listening.
That's a tough shift.
Yeah. That was just 5 days a week. On a Sunday, I did noon till 6 p.m. live. And I also had a Saturday night show that was, I recorded it, and that one went on the air between 6 and midnight. That's how many hours I was on the air at that radio station. But anyway, between 7 and midnight, and I took phone calls. And some of them were requests, so they'd want a particular tune. And some of them, I would think of a song that perfectly fit what they were talking about and go straight into that. They might have just been telling me a story or something that happened to them or something, and then I'd play, yeah. You know, a bad example is they'd be talking about something on a bike, and I'd play the Push Bike song by The Mixtures, which is a terrible, almost novelty song. But, you know, I would try and...
Tie it all together
so the kind of the bit lasted longer than the 90-second phone call. It lasted the length of the song as well, you know. Or sometimes there was a song with a funny intro that would match what they'd just been saying. Anyway, we got these consultants in to tell us, you know, how to do radio, and they came up with this format. this format.
I just see consultants with looking at a bunch of stats and figures.
Oh yeah,
around a table.
Yeah.
With we looked. Yes, this radio is too loud.
Almost.
You play that too.
Almost. They would look at a set of figures, ratings figures, and they'd go, "You're playing too much 70s music." They literally would do that. Anyway, they built this. Wow. They built this format clock that we had to follow. And really, it didn't concern me, because although a lot of program directors think they're in the content business, they're not. They're in the distribution business. They distribute the music. They make sure that there are a certain amount of music gets distributed by the radio station on the airwaves every hour. And they're obsessed with that. The bits in between, the only unique original content that the radio station has that differentiates itself from all the other radio stations in the market. And by the way, there were 20 stations in our ratings book at 2GO. We got all of the Sydney stations and all of the Newcastle stations used to get in. And they were all in our book. And the only thing that was...
That's a lot of stations.
Yeah. Well, it was north of Sydney, but south of Newcastle. But the Sydney radio stations would put their Thunder promotion vehicles on our beaches. You know, it was a very... 2GO is a very competitive market. Great place to live. Great place to work too. And... the only unique thing the radio station did, because they all play the same songs, the only unique thing they did was the bits in between the songs. So if I could, you know, find a dynamite caller that was just hilarious, that was the gold. But a program director, they don't hear that. They only hear, they will literally say to you, "That call was a bit long. We could have got another song in there." you know, I've got a guy on the phone telling me he's been abducted by space aliens and they've done weird experiments on his body. It's just hilarious because the guy's completely nuts. And I go into Starman by Bowie or something straight afterwards. But the call was a bit long. You could have got another song in there. I mean, this is really, that kind of stuff literally happened. And so they built this format clock, the consultants, that showed you what type of song you play. So at like 5 past the hour, you play a hot 80s tune. And then at 10 past the hour.
Wow.
At 10 past the hour, you play a hit that's in the charts right now. And then at 15 past the hour, you play a 60s classic song. And then at 20 past the hour, you play an 80s song, but not a hot 80s. No, one that's not as hot, maybe just a turntable hit. Not quite as good as the one you had at the top of the hour. And they build these format clocks, right? So I thought, okay, fine. Because I don't even program the music. It's all done on a computer, and they do that. I only do the bits in between. Don't concern me with your stuff. Anyway, a couple of weeks after they brought the format clock in, boss sits me down and he goes, "Oh, you're not following the format." And I'm like, "How am I not following the format? It's all preloaded. It's a computer, you know." He says, no. When you had that guy that came on and he was talking about how he wasn't, you know, he was scared of Russians, and then you played the hot 60s track." And I'm like, "What hot 60s? The Beatles, Back in the USSR." And I went, "Yeah, he was talking about Russians." And so I went straight into Back in the USSR. You're not supposed to play the hot 60s in that part of the hour. You're only supposed to play the hot 60s at 15 past the hour. I said, "Well, what am I supposed to do?" He said, "Well, only put the caller on at 15 past the hour when you're about to go into the hot 60s. I said, "Mate." And, It became a big deal. If I'm going to play that call there, then I have to go into the next song I play has to be whatever the format calls for in that hour. And the thing is, I don't know what the format calls for in that hour. I didn't load the hour. I just, you know, add a song that fits the caller. And even for requests, you know, if they requested a Billy Joel song, well, I'm sorry, you can only play the Billy Joel song. You can only put the caller on the air when there's a part in the clock that says the Hot 90s. That unless you're going to play one of Billy Joel's 70 songs, in which case, you know, you can play just the way you are. You know, some guy rings up and bleeds his heart out to a girl he just loves to bits, and he wants to play Just the Way You Are. I can only put that caller on the air in the part of the clock where Just the Way You Are, whichever way that's been categorized in the 70s, yes. where that type of song would have been. And this guy I knew quite well. We were friends. I knew him before he worked there, and he became my boss. And we pretty much fell out over that. A friendship was lost over something that stupid because he wouldn't budge. He wouldn't budge, and neither would I. So I carried on the way I was going and played them where they came up or where they just fit. It's like nobody listening would ever notice. I used to like that radio station, but they changed where they played their Hot 80s, and that was it for me. I used to like hearing Duran Duran at 10 past the hour, and I'm having to wait till 22 the following, and I'm not happy at all. That is never a complaint that's ever been leveled at a radio station.
You know what? They played a Beatles song, and I was thinking Billy Joel. Damn them!
Yeah,
I'm done.
Beatles
I'm
are
out.
Hot 60s and clearly not 70s recurrent. Clearly not. What do they think they're doing to me? Oh yeah. Not only am I never listening to them again, I'm never buying any of the products advertised in their commercials. I'll show them.
Yes.
They never
and
even.
I'm going to listen to their commercials.
Yes.
Just to know who not to buy.
To stay away from. Yeah. I'm going
just to stay away.
I'm going to listen to their commercials, and then I'm going to buy products from the commercials' direct competitors. just so the advertisers lose their market share. I'll show them.
Yeah. I'll show them.
Yeah. Radio. Ridiculous way to make a living. Music radio. Wow. And everything is so important. You play the wrong song at the wrong time. I used to, when I was at BR&B in Birmingham, if I ever wanted the studio to fill up with people, I would play a song that was not on the playlist in that point. I'd play a song that's like four songs ahead of the one I'm supposed to play next. The studio would just fill with people. The program director, the music director, they'd all just show up. What's going on? What's going on? What's going on? What? You're playing Atomic Kitten. Yeah, yeah, it's on the list. You're not supposed to play Atomic Kitten for another 20 minutes. Okay, it's like the world's not going to explode.
Ugh. At least people were listening. It was your bosses.
Well, that's right. At least the boss was listening. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but it doesn't matter. Usually, if I'd said something that got an actual complaint, they'd go, "What did you say at such and such?" And oh, I don't know. They go, "I don't know. I wasn't listening. I'm going to have to check the logging tape." But then you play the wrong song out of order. They heard that. Oh, they always hear that.
Wow.
I think they blank out when the song... I think actually when the song ends, they hold their breath and they don't breathe in again until the next song starts to try and... Because it does seem like if you talk for more than a couple of minutes, it does seem like they turn blue. It drives them... They almost die. Yeah.
They just want to hear music.
They just want to hear
music. Music that they've pre-selected.
Yes.
In that order.
Yeah. Because the record companies that took them out
according to that pie chart.
Yeah. Because the record companies that show up in town, wine and dine them, and give them free tickets to concerts, the record companies get really upset if the songs aren't played exactly the way they want them to be played. This week's guest is Victoria Jones. She created and edits Quick Morning News. She's a chief White House correspondent with Washington, D.C.-based Talk Media News, where her insight and analysis are made available to over 400 news talk radio stations around America and around the world. Victoria's on Skype now. And I first discovered you when I was listening to Tom Hartman's show online. And I heard your voice and I thought, hello, that's an English accent. So I Googled you, found your Twitter profile. And on there, it says LFC since birth. I don't know if many Americans would know what that means, but it means Liverpool Football Club, which is my team as well. How big a fan are you?
Well, I'm not as big of, I am a big fan, but I'm not as current as I should be because I don't have time to be. And recently what I've been doing, because I've been getting up in the middle of the night, and so I listen to the BBC World Service at 1 a.m. And so I listen to the sports updates, so I hear what they're doing. So I follow them on Twitter and do that. And I read the Liverpool Echo a bit and follow. And that, so I've been following what's been going on. And once Jurgen Klopp came in, I got quite excited because before that, it was like, what is going on? This is just awful. And I've had two cats called Emlyn. And nice. I have. Yes.
Excellent.
Two cats called Emlyn. And which a lot of people won't understand that reference, but it tells you how old I am.
You're talking 1970s. You're talking Emlyn Hughes, yeah.
Yes, no, because I thought that, you know, I thought he was amazing, you know, and I just, you know, so I got this cat and I called him Emlyn, and then I got another cat who looked like him. The first cat I had when I moved to the States looked like him, so naturally I called him Emlyn.
Right.
So anyway, so it's like, but once you are a Liverpool fan, I don't think people over here understand it so much. This is not a derogatory comment, but it's a different, although some do. You can't switch clubs.
No. No.
You can't suddenly go, oh, well, I'm going to support Everton today. Hello, did you get a lobotomy? This doesn't happen. Or you can't suddenly say, well, no, I'm going to support Arsenal. Really? Why? It doesn't, things like that don't happen in England or in Scotland. Whereas here you say, oh, no, I'm a Packers fan, but I'm going to support the such and such. Why would you do that?
Yeah.
You're a such and such fan, so you're a such and such fan.
Yeah, and I always think Liverpool is slightly different as well because it's a cultural thing. It's part of your identity.
Yeah. It's part of your identity because you've got the Kop, you've got Bill Shankly. Whether you even go back that far, which I do, and I'll never forget, you know, Bill Shankly always said, because they had it written above the where the opposing team would walk in. When they would walk into to come onto the pitch, it said, "You're now entering Anfield, the home football club." You know, we're pure gamesmanship.
Yeah,
pure gamesmanship. And when he was asked, he said in an interview, you know, I was asked whether football is a matter of life and death. No, it's not. It's very much more important than that.
And to get back to your point about another team, one of my favourite quotes from the great Bill Shankly is, if Everton were playing in my back garden, I'd close the curtains.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
Yeah. So
one of the things I always remember growing up was, and we lived in a suburb, was that on a Saturday afternoon, if there was a derby,
yeah,
how much crime went down.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It's everything. It really is everything. It's the closest thing I have to a religion. So I was glad to see it on your Twitter feed there. So where did you grow up?
I grew up in Formby.
Okay. North of Liverpool. Yeah. Or the northern part of Liverpool. Yeah.
Northern part of Liverpool on the train because we used to take the train to school. So, you know, I used to know what you knew all the stations.
And what did your parents do for a living?
My father's a doctor.
Yeah.
And my mum stayed home.
Yeah. And what were you into as a kid?
Trouble.
Explain.
Well, I mean, you know, I was into acting and that and stuff like that. But I really, I was into playing and riding my bike up and down the road And I was into imaginary games, actually, a lot. Imaginary games and making things up, you know, and telling stories and, you know, using my imagination and things like that. And I had imaginary friends and doing a lot of that kind of stuff. But I had real friends too. Carol, who lived down the road at number 22. I lived at number 11. And other friends like that, but that's sort of thing that I was into, and at school, and school was, you know, school was in Birkdale,
right?
My primary school was in Birkdale, and so yeah, that's what I'd say. But acting was very interesting to me always, and English, those were my areas of interest. I was not interested in, you know, science type stuff. That's what I was interested in. But I remember I ran away from school. I remember running away from school, and I thought it was a great wheeze, and I'd planned it for weeks. And I told school that my mother needed me and that she was ill. And I planned this, and I walked all the way, because you weren't allowed to walk from school to Birkdale station by itself. So I walked in uniform to the school, to the station, got the train back to, and walked, and my mother always picked me up, walked home down the street, arrived at home in the early afternoon, and told my mum that I was ill and I'd been sent home.
So you got two stories there going on either end.
So she phones the school. And oh my God, I got my comics cancelled. I got June and School Friend cancelled. That was the comic. And I can't remember what the other comic was. I had two comics, June and School Friend, and the other one, they were both cancelled. And I waited for those comics every week. They were cancelled. And I wasn't allowed out in the garden for a month. And at school, I wasn't allowed to play with the other girls during recess for about a month. I had to sit next to the teacher on duty.
So it wasn't worth it. Crime didn't pay.
Crime did not pay. No. It was dreadful. It was so humiliating. I don't even know why I did it. It was an adventure.
And did you have other brothers and sisters?
Had an older brother, David.
How much? What's the difference?
Nearly 3 years.
Okay, right.
So 3 years. Yeah, we were very close.
Yeah.
Very close.
And where did your interest in media come from?
That started really when I was at boarding school. And I was thinking about that this morning when I heard you lived in Hertfordshire.
I live in Hertfordshire now. Yeah, in Hitchin. Yeah.
In Hitchin, because I went to boarding school in Hertfordshire.
Did you? Whereabouts?
Bushy.
Okay, yeah.
Hertford. And one of my teachers, who was legendary, she was horrible to me, but she put on a Sonny Lumiere sound and light show. And I was good at acting. I was often cast in acting, and she put on this sound and light show. We didn't know what a sound and light show was, but she put it on in front of the school. And it was a big school in front of the school in what was essentially the car park, but which also had a sweep of lawn behind it. And it was going to tell the history of the school. It was an old school going forward from pre-Victorian times. And she cast me as Queen Victoria. So we go to start rehearsals, and she sits me down, and it's a sound and light show, and we go to rehearse, and I'm in front of the microphone, and it's a proper mic like you're sitting in front of, and I sit in front of this microphone, and I start practicing as Queen Victoria in a Victoria voice, as I thought it was. I'm sitting in front of a mic, and it's like something about it. I'm about 13, something about it, and I never forgot it.
The trap was set.
Trap was set. And then the second time I did it was when I was shortly after I left school, and I don't know, I think it was in a in a club or something like that. I did it again in a DJ situation. It was like, oh no, this is, there's nothing else. There's nothing like this. And there's never been anything other for me than wanting to speak into a microphone.
So how did you get your first break doing that?
Well, there's a lot of stories we want to gloss over here, actually.
Okay, sure.
But I think there's just been a lot of kindness, and there's just been, you know, there's a lot of applying for jobs that you know, this has happened to you, I'm sure, you applied for jobs that you were better qualified for than anybody else and you didn't get them. Mm-hmm. You know, like I was watching the tribute to George Michael at the Brit Awards the other night. I was watching it online, and they were saying how they kept sending off all these cassettes, and they were all rejected. Mm. And I'm thinking, this was ridiculous. This was Careless Whisper they were sending off.
Yeah.
And finally one was accepted. And that is a similar thing. And I'm not comparing myself, but it's a similar thing. Suddenly one person says, okay, you can do this. And as it happened with me, I'd done a couple of small things in England, but I'd gone to, my parents had emigrated to Australia, and I'd gone to Australia for a trip. And my mum had been very insistent. She said, there's a vacancy at this radio station. You've got to apply for it. And she kept nagging me. And I did apply, but then she kept nagging me to follow up because the guy kept putting me off saying, call me back in a week, call me back in a week. And I didn't have the gumption because it was so intimidating to keep making the call. And she kept sitting me down by the phone and making me make the call. And I phoned back every week for a month. And then in the end, he said, no, you've got the job. He said, you've always had the job. I wanted to see how keen you were.
Yeah.
And that was one of the biggest lessons of my life.
Yeah, because this business, it's going to eat you up and spit you out. You've really, really got to want it. Especially at the beginning. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, okay. So not only do you have to persist, but often it's the last call that you make.
Yeah. And whereabouts in Australia was that?
It was in Perth. Which is where my father just died, in Perth, which is one of the most beautiful cities in the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
Astonishingly beautiful.
Funnily enough, I got my first radio break in Australia.
Come on!
No, my wife and I, well, my parents emigrated to New Zealand when I was 18. When I was 21, they came home and left me there. I never actually left home. I was abandoned on the other side of the world, as I like to say.
I was abandoned in England.
What happened to you?
Oh, it doesn't matter, but that's fascinating. We're both abandoned. Yeah, anyway,
we're both abandoned. Anyway, so I'm in New Zealand, and I was working on a construction site. I was a pipe fitter on an oil refinery construction site. I got onto the maintenance side of the business, and I studied heating, ventilating, and air conditioning. And my wife and I went on holiday to Sydney for a week. We came back and sold the house. And at the age of, I think I was about 26, it was 1990. I was born in 64, whatever the maths are there. We moved to Sydney, and I worked as an air conditioning engineer in Sydney, listening to the talk radio in Sydney, which I found fascinating on AM. And I said to Julie one day when I came home from work, I've worked out what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. That is what I'm going to do. And so I went to community radio in Sydney and all the rest of it. I went to the Australian Film, Television and Radio School. I was lucky enough to be accepted on that. And I got my first job in the outback in a town called Parkes in the central west of New South Wales. And I did the afternoon drive show on Hits and Memories 2PK. And that was my first job. And then I worked at bigger and bigger radio stations, ended up back on the east coast, the central coast, just north of Sydney. And then realized I was still British. I'll send some cassettes, like hundreds of cassettes, to radio stations all over Britain, and then eventually a radio station in Bournemouth on the south coast took me on to do breakfast at 2CR. So that, yeah, that's weird. We were both abandoned and we both started out in Australia. How about that? So which...
Tell me, how hot was Parkes?
Parkes used to get very... You could dry the washing in about 10 minutes. Yeah, it was stinking hot. Yeah, yeah.
I'll bet. you know, I'm watching a show, right? I just started watching this show called The Code. Have you seen it?
No.
It's a Netflix show. It's set in Australia, set in Sydney actually. And but a lot of it takes place in the outback. It is absolutely riveting. You have to watch The Code.
The Code. Okay. Well, have you ever seen the movie The Dish? The Dish is about parks. There's an Australian movie called The Dish. If you get a chance, watch that. It's set in parks. In 1969, when Armstrong walked on the moon, the TV pictures came through the dish at parks.
Wow. And
there's a movie about that. So that everything you would need to know about parks. And it was an amazing experience being out there. And for you, what was it like then? Finally, you know, you've got this image of what working in broadcasting is like, and it's something you want to do. The trap's been set. What was it actually like when you started doing it?
Well, Australia was wonderful in some ways. My time in Australia, which was brief, was really wonderful. It was really a golden time in a way. It was a very happy time for me because it was a happy time with my parents, and some of the time prior to that had not been. And I was able to combine, because sometimes working in radio doesn't pay that well, and so you have to do other things. And so I happened to be, because I taught myself when I was, I don't know why I had, but I had very bad handwriting. And I was always chastised at school for this. And I had taught myself to type very early, watching the television, just sitting watching the television. I was a very fast typist. And I got this job and in Western Australia, as a court reporter. Now, not using one of those machines like they use on Law and Order and stuff. They do it differently in Australia, or at least they do in West Australia at the state Supreme Court. What they do is they use audio, or they did then, they used audio cassette tapes. And they were 6 or 7 minute tapes. And they had a pool of us in the basement. And what they would do is they would tape the proceedings as they would go in 6 7-minute segments, and then they would rush the tapes down, and we'd be down there, and we would type these tapes verbatim, and then a woman would read them, correct anything that was wrong, and they would get the transcripts back to the lawyers by lunchtime.
Wow.
They expected those transcripts.
And they'd have to be perfect as well, because this is a legal perfect document. Yeah.
But these women who listened, they had amazing hearing. And some of them were quite difficult because there's a lot of immigrants. So you would have, particularly with the crew, I mean, the civil cases were very dull, but they were much easier to do usually in terms of testimony. But some of the criminal cases were very difficult because there were a lot of immigrants. And so you would have Greek immigrants or Italian immigrants testifying, and you might have interpreters testifying. You might have Aboriginal witnesses testifying, and everybody would have an accent, and you would be trying to hear this, and you would have to get it right. And there was also a protocol whereby with a witness, particularly a criminal witness, you had to put exactly what they said, but with the lawyers, you could clean it up a bit to make it grammatical.
Okay.
And it was riveting. And you might get like a really good murder. And you'd be literally going as fast as you could, as fast as you could, because it's like typing an Agatha Christie. If you get the defendant or a witness who's saying, well, and then she comes in and she's got an axe. And she wields it and there's blood spurting. And you're going like this, you're typing so fast, and then suddenly the tape ends. So you rush to the pool, and you say, can I have the next tape, please? So you grab the next tape, but of course it's not the next tape, because you can't be fast enough to get the next tape. So two other women have got the next two tapes. You're now 20 minutes further on, and you don't know what happened next. Unless you go and ask the other woman, and everybody else is working so fast that until you get to your coffee break, you don't find out what happened in the court case.
Wow.
That was a wonderful job. Yeah. So I did that part time. And I did, anyway, so nobody wants to know about that. But it was such a great job.
Excellent.
It was such fun. And I've never typed so fast in my life. I must have done 80, 90 words a minute in that job.
So you're doing that as well as the radio stuff. And what radio stuff are you doing as a rookie?
What I'm doing is I'm producing classical shows for somebody else. And I'm also doing my own music shows, which I have complete free reign over. And I'm allowed to do these music shows that I get to just talk about. So it's really music talk.
Yeah, like a magazine format, really.
Like a magazine format.
Yeah.
So that's sort of my first exposure to the idea that I can just talk and give opinion.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was very interesting. And then I got to do interviews as well.
Yeah.
So I did that. And so that's what I was doing there.
So how did you go from that to the USA? Did you come back to Britain first? What's the story there? How do we connect those dots?
There's a lot of dots, some of which we'll gloss over. But I went back, gloss, and back to the UK and do various things, do various radio type things. And I, through a series of surprising events that would take an hour to tell about, but which end up with a strange serendipitous event of me being in Palm Springs for a convention and then staying with this woman who I didn't really know after the convention for a vacation for a couple of days, listening to a talk show, and an American talk show. And I'd been working, doing some radio in England. And I was at a point, this is like 1986. And I was at a point where I just didn't feel like, things were okay in England. But I just felt like I want something new. I was restless. I think if it had been the 18th or 19th century, I would have been thinking about packing a bag. I think I'm one of those people. And I listened to this talk show, and I'll remember this the rest of my life. I think I was in the bedroom putting on makeup, and I thought, I can do that. I'm better than him.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then it came to me, I'm going to do that.
Yeah. And did you have any idea how you were going to do that? How are you going to make the move to the US? Yeah. That's not the important thing, is it, when you get to that point?
No, not really. I mean, there were various steps that were taken, and it was a complicated process, but...
You say complicated, what, career-wise or in getting, like, work permits and immigration-wise?
All of that, but it ultimately worked out. It was complicated career-wise. It was complicated, obviously, visa-wise. But it worked out in the end. You know, it took a while, but I did come back and I did do it and I did it. And one of the things that struck me when I went back to England and started telling my friends. I've always had a lot of girlfriends. I've never had a lot of men friends. I've had men who are friends, that kind of friends. Never had a lot of men friends, but I've got girlfriends who are married or girlfriends who are living with men. And I tell my girlfriends, I'm going to the States. I'm going to do talk radio.
Yeah.
And they'd be really nervous about it. What I found really interesting, and I'll never forget this as long as I live, was that the men would say, and they knew me, they'd say, good, go for it.
Yeah.
Do it.
Yeah.
And the girls would say, women, they were 30, what if it goes wrong? what if she fails? What if it goes wrong? They'd say, so what? She comes back.
Yeah.
And that support, that confidence, that do it.
Yeah.
Was amazing to me.
Yeah. And how did you get that first job? Was it the same system, sending out tapes and bothering people?
It was bothering people. It was ultimately, and I'm not going to go into great detail here, for various reasons. I don't want to go into great detail here because there are people I don't want to talk about and things like that. So, I had a contact and I talked to the person and then I made phone calls and spoke to people and just kept talking to people and slowly things worked out and it was slow and it was difficult and things took quite a long time. But you know, and I told my parents, and they were very supportive.
Right. And at this stage, they're in Australia, and now
they're not asking
why you're not moving to Australia.
Well, I'd already been in Australia.
Yeah.
And but they, my mother had lived in the States for a while before she met my father. So she understood the States, and my father adored the States. He would, I think, have liked to have lived in the States. New York was his favorite town, and he loved San Francisco. Mum lived in San Francisco, and he just not loved the idea of me moving there, but he completely understood the allure of me moving to the States.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Dad Dad understood the allure of moving to a new continent.
Yeah.
Because he'd done it.
Yeah.
They understood.
Yeah.
So they were very supportive.
Find out how Victoria got on when she first moved to America and how she was accepted by American radio audiences in part two of my chat with her in 2 weeks' time. Next week, we'll check back in with one of my favourite American radio duos on the air, the married couple Gene and Julie in North Carolina, next week on London Calling. In the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Graham Mack. You want to hear more Mac Nuggets? Check out my website, macmedia.co.uk, and subscribe to my Bob FM show on iTunes. Got a question or something to say? Send me an email. Put your phone number or your Skype details in the email, and I might talk to you on the show. My email address is graham@macmedia.co.uk, and you spell Graham like the cracker, Mac like the truck. Till next week. Ta-da.